the title kept changing. I actually didn't know when I was supposed to speak. I was hoping it wouldn't be the first talk. I actually wrote this at 6 o'clock this morning thinking, oh, I'm not going to speak on the first day. Okay. Just to introduce myself, I am a physician. I see patients. That's how I make my money, and I also do some modeling. I'm going to probably emphasize more what I think are problems that come from the medicine side that maybe some mathematicians might want to help us out. And I would like to encourage an interchange between mathematicians and medical people to learn what the real problems are. And that's really going to be what I'm going to talk about, because it's something what I've been thinking about for the last couple of years. I run an epilepsy clinic. I just wrote a book on epilepsy patients with my colleagues and people who contributed things. And you might think, if you were to ask me as a doctor what would be the major problems in medicine, I would stand back and start talking to you about, oh, we can't control medically intractable seizures, and we need better imaging techniques to know where the seizures are and things like that. That's the small view of medicine. It's from my little clinic. I'd like to get more business in my clinic, because remember, medicine is a business, and if you give me a new tool, it translates into more business. But fortunately, I married a lady who's from the business world. And if you were to think about what are the challenges, I mean the real, what's going to bury the American economy for the next 20 years, it's how to manage 77 million baby boomers. Think of it, 40 million Alzheimer's all presenting within a year or two. Okay? The sheer size is, if you actually start working out, even if we were going to manage migraine headaches in that cohort, it is more than the current U.S. medical budget alone. The other problem is that the baby boomers, of which my gray hair makes me one and many people, we have a totally different attitude towards medicine. We're probably not going to let the medical system treat us like our parents. Okay? And in contrast to the way hospitals have run for years, hospitals make money how? By bringing patients into the hospital so you can bill them. The medical system, if it's going to survive this onslaught, must keep people out. How do you make money if you're billing nobody? Okay, that's a toughie. Okay? And if you start to look in the journals, you're going to realize that the medical priorities of at least the United States, and I don't know about Canada, are very different. Just pick up new journals and start reading about it. 65% of Americans are overweight, and over 40% are literally obese. That's a very big health problem. That's 40% of 300 and some million. We're talking a lot, okay? People are getting much more concerned about exercise. Everybody knows exercise is good. How many actually do it? Okay. Wellness and fitness. Everybody's important. Somebody actually does it. How do you motivate people to exercise? You tell a patient, you're going to die next year if you don't lose 30 pounds in exercise. They do it for about 2 weeks. Okay. Quality of life and neural rehabilitation, which is what I started thinking about. Because I realized that my work actually isn't in any of these things. And it was struck home to me that a couple years ago, a new anticonvulsant medication came out, and the remarkable thing did is it took off 40% of people's body weight. And I suddenly changed patients in my clinic who were on 10 medications, who were miserable all the time. Can you imagine going from 300 pounds to 180? What change I just made in that patient's life. Real. And if on the epilepsy side, they still had the same number of seizures. I had a patient that was not taking blood pressure medication anymore, was not on antidepressants, they were no longer on their insulin. I gave them their life back. And so these things that we don't think about at all, in fact, nobody at this meeting on mathematics or medicine, are going to talk about any of the problems that we really truly face in a country in healthcare. So I think we have to keep that in mind, that we're doing little things from the laboratory that are fun to do, but may not directly fit into saving the country's budget in the United States. Questions I became interested in is, how do we gain motor skills, okay, and how do we regain them after we lose them? This gentleman over here has Parkinson's. Okay, he's about an 85 handicapper. He plays better golf now with Parkinson's than he did before he got Parkinson's. But how do we teach this person to regain the skills, and how did this guy learn to be so good? Okay, and the important thing about motor skills and also learning mental skills like recognizing faces, how do you learn to recognize familiar faces, that's it, is repetition. That's the key. We learn how to walk by repeating how to walk. We learn how to hit golf balls by learning how to hit golf balls. We have many kinds of repetition. Okay, practice, learning to play a piano, learning to hit a golf ball. Workplace activities, workplace, overuse industry, injuries, carpal tunnels, elbow tunnels, shoulders, backs, all the way down. Passively acquired postures. I want all of you, when you're sitting out there at coffee break, stand up very relaxed and tell me which way the back of your hands are pointing. I bet you dollars to donuts over half, they're going to point directly forward. How should they anatomically, how did God build you to design at your sides? Why are they like that? Because all of you hunch over in your desk. You have a rounded, stoop posture. That means if you haven't seen a doctor in a neurology clinic yet, you soon are, because you're going to have back pain, muscle contraction headaches, lots and lots of aches and pains. And they can be passively. If you go and examine patients who are chronically care patients in a bed, the simple weight of the blankets lying on their feet, sticking underneath, actually puts changes in the nervous system. The nervous system adapts, so it gets repetitive weight of the blankets on that. Now, what are the two major downsides for repetition, if that's the only way you can acquire motor skills? Well, the first thing is it takes a long time. Okay? A long time. In fact, here's studies that probably Fran knows much, much better than I, where people tried to see how many trials did you have to do to get your reaction time down. Okay? And the first thing to notice, it's a scaling law. This is a log-log plot, which means that when you first start, you kind of acquire skill pretty easy, feels pretty good. Okay? I learned how to ride my bicycle almost, but to get up to Lance Armstrong level, I'm going to have to practice a long time. Okay. And the question now becomes is, if you had to rehabilitate this guy, and I somehow skipped over a slide, which may pop up later for all I know, how many repetitions are we talking about? And people have done this by measuring knitting sweaters and tying cigars and all this stuff. It's around 1 million repetitions to get to a skilled level. And I mean not just doing it to be really skilled. This guy's 70 years old. He wants to learn to hit a golf ball after his stroke. He might be able to hit 100 a day. That's going to take him 30 years. Now, in neurology, this is a big problem, because we talk about doing neural transplants to help out a stroke person, robotic limbs like that. Whichever we want to do, he still has to learn how to use it. Okay, and I've got a big trouble. What's the other downside? Repetitions cause injuries. Right? So here I am trying to rehabilitate this guy by making him repeat just golf. This is the one I like talking about. You know, the injury rate is around 60%. That's more than it is for hockey. Okay? So it is a high, and just to get you some, back injuries, elbow injuries, shoulder injuries, hand injuries, psychological injuries. Okay? Okay, here was the one where I had my million. It's somehow left over there. So what we decided to do in our lab was to start to try to think of an experiment over the years where we could look at acquiring motor skills. Because I'm a neurologist. I can't do an awful lot about obesity except pass out medications and things like that. And so what I thought was, what's the most important thing about motor control or skilled movement? It's good balance control. I used to be a hockey player. If you can't stand up on your skates, you can't score a goal. Okay? You can't hit a baseball on your back. You can't walk around the room. You can't even get in and out of a car or anything like that. So that's try balance control, either static or movement. Now, the interesting thing is you can walk without a nervous system, and that's due to a Canadian worker named McGeer, who might have been Waterloo or something like that. So these little walking toys, you've all seen them. So walking is not clear what the nervous system does for walking, but for balance control, standing in a single place, the nervous system is the only thing that keeps you up there. Okay, and that's my kitchen floor. That's my foot. And here I am just holding a video camera to show you that I move always around my center of pressure, my center of gravity. Okay. People have done that in a much more sophisticated manner. This is a force platform, which you can buy. They're like $10,000 each. There's a whole industry out there of different kinds of force platforms. Everybody seems to have them, and then they want to get rid of them next year, and there's a big glut on the market. Okay. Collins and Jim Collins down in Boston with his colleague DeLuca were the first people, I think, to really start looking at these little fluctuations in a systematic way, because they realized when you look at the noisy properties or whatever of a system very, very carefully, that gives you a non-invasive way of actually understanding how the system might be working. We don't pay enough attention, I think, in the statistical fluctuations and their nature when we're really looking at data. And that's really about the only way we can do some things. And what they noticed is if you looked at the two-point correlation function, which is here on a log lot, it had three scaling regions. Okay, so it wasn't just like Brownian, which would be just a straight line. It's had three regions where if you were trying to fit that kind of relationship to it, there would be three choices of H. Okay, and what they said was, now, this is a thing like this. It's like your thermostat over there. When I'm trying to balance my control here, am I using continuous feedback? Which is what mathematicians I did when I built a model in the pupil light reflect with André Longtemps. I don't know where he is out there. And it had continuous control in it. But, you know, that thermostat doesn't work with continuous feedback control. It works on bang-bang control. Temperature's higher than some point, turn the furnace off. Temperature's lower than some point, turn it back on. What Jim said in his model was that as long as my fluctuations aren't too far away from the midline, don't do anything about it. You're not going to fall. Why worry about it? Turn on my nervous system when the fluctuations get a little bit bigger beyond the threshold. And the common, the interesting thing about this model, it's non-predictive, right? Because all you got to do is measure the threshold. You don't really care what it's doing like that. And the nice advantage of it, I think, from a cognitive point of view, is that it prevents the nervous system from being overloaded by sensory information. It's just looking for things crossing a threshold. It really doesn't care about that. And it means that it can do something else. Okay, but the big question for his model, I think, was how does this work? And that's where I kind of got interested, especially because this is a sine rate from Chicago. We're in our sixth or seventh year of, thank God you guys escaped, okay, spec delays, okay. And just to remind everybody, it takes quite a bit of time from a signal to go from your foot to your head, 40 milliseconds, or from your hand to your head, 20 milliseconds. Okay, the curious thing is that whereas in the nerves and spinal cord up, things go at meters per second. Once you get to the brain, it's only in centimeters per second, so our brain is actually slower than we think. But the essential properties of the feet postural control are the presence of this time delay. There is some kind of feedback. You certainly know when you're getting out there. But there's also noise. There's clearly these things. And so we started thinking about what are the properties of the simplest model you can think of. And the first person I work with is Toru Ohiro, who now works with Sony Corporation, one of the few people that actually got a good-paying job working on delay equations that I know of. Okay, and his idea was to think of a random walker, so just think of this as a random walk, except that when you flip your coin, it doesn't depend on where you are now. It depends on where you were in the past. Okay, and you bias it a little bit, so you tend to make your correction towards the midline of that. And he was able to get a two-point correlation that had two of the scaling regions that Jim Collins had done. Along came my German guy, that's Christian Jurek, who's now in Bremen University, still is a good colleague and a good friend of us. He wanted to be a real physicist, so he wrote down a second-order differential delay equation for an inverted pendulum. I don't have any way of doing it, which has a time-delayed feedback, which is the G term, and it has a noisy input. He was doing additive noise. Okay, this is additive noise. It doesn't depend on the state of the system. There's no theta over here. Okay, additive noise. When he did a simple approximation for the human case, which means it's basically overdamped, okay, and he made the feedback very sharp, he found that the system was bistable. If you added this additive noise, so it would flip back and forth between the basins of attraction, you could reproduce completely the data of Collins, even the data that Collins didn't publish in his papers. But a lot of people don't like that model because is the noise really additive, okay? And is this assumption here that it's overdamped in that direction really, really right? Fortunately, for me, is 1 year in my grant, there was an oversight. Please don't say anything, Hugh. And what NIH gave me for my grant funding 1 year, and I had a little bit of extra money. Basically, what they did, they gave me my 1 year supply money in a 9 month period, and then the next budget because of some screw up over our billing thing. So I had a little bit of money, okay, which is not that common. And I had been talking to my nephew, and I realized that in 3D motion analysis, okay, because of the video game industry, the equipment and technology that's come over is truly, truly incredible. Okay, it is nothing to get a video camera with 1 millisecond, to measure a point moving in space with 1 millisecond If you want a tenth of a millisecond precision, that is really easy. And you can get down to just a few microns of accuracy. That's an incredible data source. Juan Luis is my good friend from Spain. He was interested in, he's an expert, I guess, in time-delayed dynamical systems with parametric noise. That's noise that depends on the state of the system. Almost all noise in the nervous system you think about is probably parametric. It's probably state-dependent. So that's the real stuff. Nobody works on it because I think it's hard. Okay? But nevertheless, that's the real stuff. And one day we were sitting in the lab and we wanted to test these expensive cameras we got. Okay? And we thought, well, wouldn't it be fun just to balance a stick on our fingertip, okay, and see what the dynamics look like. Now, this is quite different than the way people do most of their experiments. Most people do experiments without hypothesis. We didn't have a hypothesis. We just wanted to have fun with the two cameras we had just done. Just to point out here, these are little reflective markers, okay? They are very, very light. This whole stick is about the size of a quarter-inch dowel, so like a pencil. Okay, that's why I'll sometimes use the word pencil instead of stick, and I apologize. The one camera, okay, it sends out infrared light and reflects it off. It gets X and Y inside the camera, X and Y coordinates. The two cameras triangulating together get the third dimension. So that's how it gets X. So you always need two. If you're trying to swing do a golfer, you need 11 cameras. Okay, the rough price of this, a camera that does it at 250 hertz is about $25,000. The camera to do it at 1,000 hertz at the time we were doing it was about $140,000. And if you want to go to the 0.1 10,000 hertz cameras, they're around a quarter of a million right now. Okay, so you can imagine 11 cameras, how much money you're talking. Okay. And of course, the reason we wanted to stick balancing, keep all the mathematicians on board. First, the time delay is obviously important. You can't balance a pencil on your fingertip, but if the stick were very long, you can. Why? Because when the stick gets long, its rate of movement slows to eventually it slows to the point that you can make a correction before it gets too far away. This is a well-beaten up engineering benchmark program. Everybody wants to stabilize an inverted pendulum. You got really good data. And what we liked about it is you could measure skill objectively. What's the average number of time you can keep a stick up? You keep about 1 minute, and before you only kept it up 10 seconds, you obviously got better. People had tremendous pressure to get better because it was boring to do the experiment. Okay. And this is how, just to show you what you like, you have to keep your back on the chair, so that makes the experiment rather difficult. The movement really isn't at the fingertip, it's really back here in the shoulder. You can actually keep your hand extended and rigid, and notice that her eyes are looking exactly at the tip. Okay, if she were to look halfway down the stick, okay, then it would be exactly like doing the experiment if you had half the length of stick. So in other words, it's really the visual angle that she's trying to do. There's something wrong with that analogy because if you made a little teeny-weeny stick down here, maybe that high, and you put a video light so it was up in the ceiling and tried to do it, it doesn't work. So at some point, the velocity picks up on me, but at least in the range of stick sizes we're doing, she's looking at the vertical angle. The very first experiment we did was simply to measure the vertical displacement angle, theta. Okay, we're measuring it from the vertical, so when cos theta is 1, that means the vertical angle is 0. Okay, as a function of time for two lengths of stick. Okay. And what you notice is that the angle is always fluctuating. Sometimes it makes really big fluctuations. Well, not really big. We're talking fractions of a degree. And other times, teeny-weeny little ones. Okay. And then what we did is, but the interesting thing is it's not fluctuating around precisely the vertical position, but off a little bit. So it could be a low amplitude limit cycle or whatever. I'm not going to worry about that. We put a red line in, okay, and measured the crossings in the upward direction because those are corrective. Okay? And then what we're going to do is measure the times between successive corrective movements. Okay? Because you've got a guy who's interested in parametric noise and things like that. And so when we plot the probability that the time between the two successive corrective movements is a certain size versus the log of that size, we get a scaling relationship. That's a log-log plot. The curious thing about that is the time delay is about here. So 98% of the corrective movements are shorter than the delay, which is interesting, you know, because one of the things we were worried about is what does the system do? You're standing here, I'm a human, and I'm standing here, and I get a perturbation. It takes me half a second to make my correction and actually do it. I mean, what happened in the 499 milliseconds in between? Okay. So here we've got a situation where, in actual fact, 98% of the corrective movements are faster than the delay. So where the heck are we coming from? And they also have a scaling relationship. Now the scaling relationship, that slope of that black line there is -3/2, which is the scaling relationship for something that the mathematicians called on-off intermittency. It's the kind of on-off intermittency that arises because of stochastic forcing of a control parameter across the stability boundary. So this experiment is really telling us that somehow this system of stick balancing is very, very close to a boundary and is actually intermittently becoming unstable. You could look at it that way. The other thing is that if you did the power spectrum of these fluctuations, you also get a scaling region. That little bump up there has nothing to do with the stick balancing. If you close your eyes and you pretend to balance a stick and measure what your hand is doing, you would get that little peak up there, so it's something in the neuromuscular mechanical properties of your arm. You get a slope of -0.5, and somebody has showed that's exactly the slope you should get if you have on-off intermittency. And there's another slope that's about twice, 2.5, something like that. Make a model. I'm getting shorter and shorter. Have you got your thing? Your light? Well, if not. Okay. Just to show that you could kludge up some kind of model for this, this is just our inverted pendulum equation. Okay, what we did is we have a gain in front of our feedback term, and in that gain we're going to put noise. Okay, so it's going to end up being multiplicative noise. Here is the stability space for that equation minus the noise term. Okay, so in other words, if you picked R0, this term, that's R0 plus a noise term, so R0 is just that, the term that goes there. And delay, this coefficient that goes up in front of this term is just a function of the delay. Keep everything else constant. If you pick values inside this lens-shaped area, the pencil would stay up forever. Why it doesn't, I don't know. Why didn't it pick those? Here are four different choices, okay? So if you pick there, which is just on that side, the pencil sort of would oscillate slowly off to infinity. In the middle, it stays there forever. On this side, boom, goes the other way. Right here, very close to the boundary, it duplicates the kind of dynamics we're seeing experimentally. And you can show that because, for example, here's the power spectrum when the parameters are chosen just to be that spot. And you get your scaling region -1/2, and you get your other one around 2.5. When you try to look at the scaling law for the times between the fluctuations, the system very, very, very slowly converges to the -3/2. And that's because we're right on a stability boundary. So the real part of the eigenvalue is almost zero, which means it's going to take critically forever to get down there. So why that doesn't happen in the nervous system, I don't know. But at least it's in that. There's lots of things wrong with the model. This term up here should probably be a function of theta. The engineers will tell you the feedback should also be a function of velocity, and on it goes. But that's enough just to tell you that it's in the right ballpark. And so the curious thing about here, here's my little Mickey Mouse model being a physician. Here's my little two-parameter space. Pick a value of this parameter and that value so the parameters, the pencil stays out forever. Duh. You know, you pick one in the middle, right? That sounds pretty easy. And then you say, okay, there's a little bit of noise. Okay, let's make a little boundary around here and just pick it inside that middle. And what the nervous system is wanting to do is it wants to pick up out here on that edge, which is very, 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 very strange. One of its advantages is it makes controlling movements shorter than the delay. Maybe that helps. The fluctuations out here do measure a random, resemble a random walk whose average angular displacement is zero, so that seems to work. But it's rather bizarre to be out there. Well, what about the movements of the fingertip? Here's what the movements of the fingertip do while you're doing this, okay? X and Y, Z is coming out of the board, so we just projected it down. So the movements aren't really smooth. It's making lots of little steps. When we're watching on the film, that nice lady move her finger, she's moving along like that, but as it's going along there, it's making lots and lots of little steps. So what we decided is to look at this as a random walk. Okay, so what do those little steps look like? Okay, and remember the units of a random walk are velocity. It's distance moved per unit time. People never usually seem to talk about the units for a random walk, so we're going to talk about Vs. That's why we're talking about Vs, and we're going to talk about delta Vs because we want a high-pass filter to the data because we're not interested in these long trends. We're interested in the little short ones. Okay, and here are the distributions that you get. Now, I have these coefficients all mixed up, so just pretend that they were written correctly and things like that. But we were interested in, we had an idea that this was going to end up being a Levy flight. Okay, and just remember that a Levy flight is a random walk, and the probability that a step size of a certain length, S, occurs is S to the minus alpha. Okay, the 1 over alpha shouldn't be there. Okay, and the way you can change the step size is just by changing the digitization rate. Okay, and so you're interested in looking at the distribution of the delta V's as a function of the distribution rate. If it's Gaussian, there shouldn't be any effect, right? Okay, and here's really what happens. The black data is the delta V's measured while somebody's balancing a stick. The solid line here is Gaussian. So they're clearly not Gaussianly distributed, okay? And as the sampling rate gets finer and finer, right down to 1,000 hertz, we begin to realize that this starts to look a little bit like a Levy distribution. Okay, and the one way you can do that is if you plot the height of this peak versus the sampling time. It should be linear, which it is, and the slope of that gives you the coefficient. The real slope should be 1.25 or 1.3. With this particular example, is 1.6. So the average is 1.2 or 3. What happens when you increase skill? This is a really boring experiment. Can you imagine for 2 weeks of your life practicing stick balancing at 4 or 5 hours every day? You get really good. Okay, so at a 39-centimeter stick on day one, you would balance no trials longer than 20 seconds. By the time you got through the two-week period, you can probably do 40% of the trials. If you pick a longer stick, like a 60-centimeter stick, you'd probably get about 40% of them right the first day, 100% 2 weeks later. Okay, and here's what happens. Two different sticks. Here's what the distribution of hand movements looks like before you became skilled, and here's what it looks like after you became skilled. Same thing for the other stick length. There actually is a day in the middle, if you get it right about in the middle, where you get a combination of these two. So there is a transition day. The slope of this line, this plot of the height versus the sampling frequency, doesn't change. So this has nothing to do with the alpha in the Levy. It has something to do with the truncation of the Levy. And that's what I just said there. The reason I wrote that, in other words, you have what happens is inside a certain threshold, okay, it is really just the Levy distribution, and outside that you truncate it off with some term. Very much like what Jim Collins is talking about. Now here's the big question, and I think enough time to do. How does all this work? I started off to test two cameras, which I got by luck from NIH. I just picked up an experiment that everybody has tried. There's probably nobody in this room that has never tried to balance a stick on their fingertip. Okay? And I just got thrown at me, and I thought I knew what was doing. I thought, boy, this is just going to be a little delay equation. It's going to have a little feedback term. It's probably going to be negative feedback. I know lots about it. I got this one aced. I mean, it's going to be so embarrassing, I probably could never write up the results because everybody's going to say, so what? And now I've just got thrown a total curveball. Somebody just threw me the whole book of statistical physics and plopped it down in my lap. I don't know anything about Levy flights. I don't know anything about on-off intermittency. I don't know why I'm up on a stability boundary of all places. So how does this work? What about predictive control? Where's the predictive control right there? And the question is, do they apply more broadly? Now, so we have spent the last year or two trying to understand how you might understand this work. And I'm going to give you a hypothesis which I've stuck my neck out. I've got people in the room who are good cognitive scientists. They will probably shoot it down, but I'm going to give you a thought about what I'm doing. Now, the first thing you have to realize is that there's one big thing wrong with stability. No change. It's a resistance to change. Okay? Suppose the nervous system is not interested in resistance to change, but is interested in flexibility, like an F-14 fighter. It's going to put itself right on a stability boundary. You know, minimum effort, lots of change. So could it be trading off flexibility versus stability? In other words, it's making a trade-off, or could there be another trade-off? Well, the first thing about it that we realized where we had got ourselves wrong is we were thinking about this problem like an engineer thinks about it. We want to keep the stick up forever, so we're going to design a continuous feedback and assume the brain's doing the same thing so the stick stays up forever. But the interesting thing with our experiment is the stick always falls. So this is really not the same problem the engineers are worrying about. It's really more like a first passage time. How long does it take to get to the certain threshold beyond which you're going to fall? And how can I maximize that time the best? So it's really a first passage time problem. If you thought about what Jim Collins did and you tried to think of our experiment this way, you're going to come to the same conclusion. I just remind everybody that the risk of falling is the really thing of primary importance, and you can ask any one-year-old who will discuss that with you and just watch them walk. So we're really worried about falling, okay? And so if you were thinking about that, there is some work that tells you in an open loop way how you might be able to increase the time that something might take to escape. One is simply put the parameters out quite close to the boundary. The system can get trapped there for a little while. There's good evidence that you can put noise up there and do it. And maybe even distributing the parameters in some way sort of helps you prolong your time before you're going to fall. Well, why would you want to do that? Fortunately, this word got taken by... I took this word, I should say. It turns out that this word has been used. But here's the idea we had. So we have a mechanism here that I don't have to think about. It allows me to keep the stick up for a while. But by observations, I know if I close my eyes, the stick is going to fall. So it can't work completely, all that. And of course, your clinic always brings you back the answer. I'm a physician. I have 10 very sick patients in this room to treat. How do I do it? I don't do all 10 at the same time. I go one to one. I go look at this patient. I do something. I go to the next one. I go next one. And as I'm going along doing all this, I am giving me strategies that do what? That'll give me more time to spend on the other remaining ones. Okay. So you could begin to think about what's happening here is that by putting in this noisy mechanism, by tuning it, putting your work there, I buy time that I can do something else. So why is this important? In other words, if I get better and better tuning this, I get longer and longer time to do some other thing that my brain was really worried about. Why did this come in? Because the number of tasks that you think your brain is really unbelievably powerful, the number of tasks that you can do simultaneously, consciously, is rather limited. At one time, it was 7 plus or minus 2. There's a famous paper called that. There's some recent work out by Just using functional MRI work that if I give you one task and measure the brain activity, and then I give you a task that involves another part of the area of your brain, so now two different areas that shouldn't be competing, and now I present both tasks at the same time, the activation over here drops by 50%. So attention is a limited resource that has to be partitioned very carefully, especially if the brain begins to not want to do many, many things. So the idea is the strategy, our idea with our next way out, is the strategy here that's going on, is the brain is developing these sort of non-predictive ways of tuning the dynamics so it doesn't have to think about it for a little bit of time so it can go and do something else. And why do we think that might be true? Now, that's a tough hypothesis to prove, and we're trying to design experiments like give people other tasks while they're balancing to see once they become skilled, can they do other things easier and things like that. But the one experimental observation that we began to wonder about is, go back and try to measure the time delay for this experiment. The first thing we found is the time delay is a function of the stick length. So for a given skill level, you get a longer delay the longer stick, which is the easier stick to balance. Okay. The second thing is, and these are two, this is a cross-correlation. I realize this is not the best way to measure a time delay and things like that. But the cross-correlation for either stick is, again, shift it to higher numbers. That tau is bigger here for the more highly skilled person. This is in contrast to people learning how to tie cigars where the reaction time gets shorter as they increase skill. So how could the time delays be getting longer when people are actually getting better at it? And we said, well, maybe the time delay is actually measuring the time between successive conscious corrections. And if that were true, then my mechanism would say that the time delay would, in fact, get longer as you became more skilled, because that's the whole object. And it could also be true why the delay gets longer the longer the stick, because you don't have to make a conscious correction so often. Okay, that's your neck as far out as us little physicians can go. Since we're not billing with it, there are no lawyers involved, so I feel pretty good about that. It turns out if you measure the fluctuations in the center of pressure while you're standing on a force platform, these are not Gaussian distributed either. They may or may not be Levy. We don't have enough data yet to know. And I just wanted to kind of stir things up. Here's my myths of computational neurobiology side, which every year I line up some lines. So one myth is there's no noise in the nervous system, which is probably wrong. Because in fact, in this stick balancing task, the noise is actually quite important. There are no time delays in the nervous system. that comes from a fight I had with NIH because somebody, one of my grant reviewers a few years ago pointed that out, and I wrote back and said I was very disappointed because measuring latencies is how a neurologist makes their money. We measure those little time delays between your foot and your head, and if it's slower, we look for the block to identify things. Feedback is completely continuous, which I think may not be right. I'm beginning to wonder if you actually look at somebody moving a limb and you measure the activity in each muscle is making little discrete bursts. It's more like watching a space shuttle be landed, where little rocket models are kind of firing off. So I think it's more of a hybrid controller. Attractors are relevant. I think I put a question mark. I think we have to think about that. It could be that in an experimental preparation where we isolated the whole world away from that couple little cells, that it might be true, but is it really true when you put it into its own gemisch? Hybrid is control. I now put right with a question mark because I've had to wonder about hybrid controllers. So the engineers, that's a very tough literature for a neurobiologist to read, and I'd like any help that anybody could give me. And one of the things I used to have a really strong wrong because I thought it was totally ridiculous was whether critical phenomena, and I use that word loosely because I'm not using it in the precise physicist way of looking, but I mean tuning your parameters up really close to a stability boundary so noise becomes very important, that some of the things that people have been talking, self-organized criticality, on and all these different words that we've all heard, may in actual fact be relevant to some of the things that are going on in the nervous system. And with that, only 3 minutes over. I did okay. Thank you.